We just wrapped up our time in the book of Acts. We're going to pick that back up when our college kids come back again, and we can join them in the fall. And so we'll be in Habakkuk chapter 9 and moving forward with the rest of that story. It has been interesting, hasn't it, to hear moments like we ended last week with a man named Philip, anointed and appointed in the church in order to take care of what you'd think of as sort of an administrative problem. There's not enough food going out for the right people. It seems to be going to too much of the wrong people. And how are we going to take care of that? Philip gets elected and appointed for the job. But then Philip goes from there, and he's used in all these ways that you would think would be almost apostolic. Here's a challenge I want to leave you with as we come away from the book of Acts. Because this morning, we're jumping into the Old Testament. We're going to be in a prophet named Habakkuk. This is a totally different story, totally different time. But what I don't want us to do as we move into this different context and study this different book is forget everything that we just learned. So here's an interesting challenge. If you remember, Philip was a man who it seemed was just, he just had this conversation with this official over the queen's treasury. He just met her, it seems, circumstantially. And this official was reading out of the Old Testament, it would just seem circumstantially. And he was reading the right passage that would be very easy to talk about Jesus, almost it would seem circumstantially. And then he invites Philip up into the chariot, it seems almost circumstantially. And then he asks him, do you understand what you're reading? And you remember the story, this was just a week ago. Here's the challenge for us, I think. We could read that and ask the question, is that just something that we're only going to read about in the Bible? Or does the God who was working in Philip's life still work today? As you know, we're not going to have a lot of context in our service for a ton of different announcements. I can tell you the announcements for the next month. VBS, youth camp, we're going to have a picnic. There you go. It's not going to be all that complicated or confusing. But what if we filled up that time with our own kind of Philip challenge stories? Stories where you recognized over the last week, this might not have just been circumstantial. It might not have been that the Lord, you know, just had me bump into this person and then Jesus was able to come up in the conversation. But much like Philip and much like the Spirit was guiding Philip, there are circumstances, relationships, appointments that seemed to happen over the course of the week. And I was able to tell somebody else and bring up the conversation of what it would mean to follow Jesus in this context. What if you looked for those challenges over this summer? And maybe in the middle of the service, we could hear about some of those challenges that you accepted, that you recognized, well, the Lord seems to be helping me take this step. And I circumstantially met this person, and this circumstantially came up. And maybe it wasn't so circumstantial. Maybe it was a little bit more that the Lord was directing it. We're going to have space in the middle of our service. It'd be great to be able to hear some of those stories. We could make a logo for it and call it the Philip Challenge or something along those lines. The Acts 8 continues, or I don't know, something like that. But just be looking for ways that God could be at work in your life. We're going to pick the book of Acts up again. Let's just not let it grow cold over the summer. You get what I'm saying? So how about that for a segue to Habakkuk? We were just in the first century, right? We were in right around 30 AD. That's where the book of Acts is kind of taking place, right? In the 30s. We're going to jump all the way back into the 7th century BC. And to try and get some context for the way that the book of Habakkuk lands in the Old Testament scriptures, there's a lot of different ways of thinking through the Old Testament, right? There's the Sunday school way. Who were the main leaders of the Old Testament, the main heroes of the Old Testament? Which is a weird way to think about the Old Testament because almost every hero fails miserably, right? We've got Noah who, oh, he saves everybody in the ark. Well, he ends up drunk and naked in a tent. It doesn't really seem to go great for him. Right? We could think about all these different people, Abraham and all of his kids and grandkids and all the everything that played out from there. There's really no ultimate hero in the book of Genesis. Exodus is even kind of the same way. Moses seems like he could be a hero, but at the end of it, he doesn't even get to go into the promised land. By the time he's done, he's banished from everything he was leading everybody to because of his failure. Joshua seems to be a pretty good guy. We don't get too much of an indication, but he doesn't really appoint a successor that takes over very, very well. We have everything in the time of the book of Judges, all the kings, both in the north and the south. It's like nobody's a hero. That's a really bad way of thinking through the Old Testament. But it helps us. It helps us make our way through the chronology of it. Another way of thinking about it, though, is to think about the empires that were in charge of things. So rather than thinking about Moses, for instance, during the book of Exodus, we might think about Egypt. Egypt is a big superpower over the region that the Bible talks about geographically. But Egypt isn't the only superpower. There are two main ones that I want to bring up. The first is the Assyrians. You might think of the Assyrians through maybe one of their more popular names, their capital city of Nineveh. And if that doesn't come to mind, you might think of a more popular prophet named Jonah. Jonah was a prophet sent by God to deal with the Assyrians, who were the superpower over that region of the time. This is when Israel had their kings, and all of their kings were trying to figure out where they fit as a small little state under the superpower of Egypt. But then Egypt was getting beaten up and the Assyrians were taking over. But the Assyrians were pretty brutal people. And so Jonah was sent to them and said, hey, you folks of Nineveh, if you don't repent, God is going to wipe you out. And they repented, which really bothered Jonah, but that's a different book. Later, God sent not Jonah, but a guy named Nahum, who gave a different kind of warning. It is actually, you've had too much time now and you haven't repented fully, and so God's going to bring judgment. Well, the Assyrian army in the capital city of Nineveh was conquered by, not Egypt, but by a place called Babylon. The Babylonians show up in the book of Habakkuk under a different name. All right, they're the folks that had that sort of odd name to you, the Chaldeans. It's kind of hard to know exactly. We read it. We don't. That's the odd thing about the Old Testament. It's a dead language, more or less. Yes, people speak Hebrew today, but actually it's more of a dead language. We don't know how all these words are pronounced, but we'll call them the, what do you want, Chaldeans? Works for you? All right. I see the CH and I always want to do it that way. But we might think of them more as the Babylonians. That's an empire you might think of because of maybe a different popular prophet like Daniel. Daniel dealt with Nebuchadnezzar, who was one of the main leaders of Babylon. Habakkuk comes in that empire. Not when the Egyptians are in power, not when the Assyrians are in power, but later on when the Babylonians are in power. But that's not Habakkuk's real problem at the beginning. At the beginning, what Sarah read for us was Habakkuk crying out to God and saying, God, there is wickedness all around me. And that's what makes Habakkuk unique of all the rest of the Old Testament prophets. Every other Old Testament prophet is charged by God. He has a personal kind of prayer and commissioning from God. But then what's written down under his name in the Old Testament scriptures is more of his sermon to the people that he's talking to. That's not the way Habakkuk reads. Habakkuk begins more as an actual prayer. Oh God, oh Lord, I see wickedness around me. If this was any other prophet, he'd be saying, yo, people, I see wickedness in you. That's not the way that Habakkuk is structured. It's not so much a sermon. Chapter 2 has a bit of a sermon feel to it, but it's all recorded as a prayer. When we open up this book over the next 3 weeks, what we're going to be doing is listening in on Habakkuk talking to God. And I got to give you a warning right from the outset. This is a tough book to read. I was talking to Mary Schieferstein. We're just seeing how she was doing. And she said, hey, I saw that you guys are going to be doing Habakkuk. Or as she liked to call it, a mini book of Job. And I thought, it's not a bad illustration of the way to think about this. Because the way that Habakkuk prays toward God is like some of those psalms that we've touched at in the past that feel like, yeah, we don't write worship songs about those prayers. Because they don't feel so much like prayers. Oh, Lord, I worship you for your character. Oh, Lord, I worship you in awe of your deeds. He's coming at it more like If you go back to Jonah, the end of Jonah, where Jonah's really angry, oh God, you killed my plant. Oh God, how could you spare these people? Oh God, I accuse you. That's what Habakkuk is doing in the very beginning. Oh God, I look at all my people and I see wickedness in them. And so Habakkuk starts with one accusation, and it's this: God doesn't care. Or maybe the way we'd say it is that God is uncaring. He sees problems around him, and the Habakkuk kind of heart says, God, I care more about injustice and unrighteousness and sin than you do. When we start that way, we're on shaky ground. But Habakkuk is firmly beginning that way. Habakkuk is going to get his answer. His answer is going to relate to that empire, the empire of Babylon, or the Chalcedons, or whatever we're going to call these guys, right? That answer, though, is not satisfactory to Habakkuk at all. And so the second problem that Habakkuk is going to have with God in this prayer we're looking at today is not that God is uncaring, it's that God is incompetent. It's not that God doesn't care about what's going on, it's that if Habakkuk could rouse God to care, that God's solution for how to deal with the injustice of life really isn't all that impressive. God doesn't care, and God doesn't know what he's doing. Now, if you read like I do, and you're saying, okay, I don't know how to pronounce the word Chaldeans, it's okay. 7th century BC is a long time ago. It's in a different country. It's in a different part of the world, speaking a different language. But here's what I can bet. I can bet that you've lived enough life that you've had to have prayers where you said, God, do you care? And God, do you know what you're doing? And that's where this first chapter really grips us if we let it. This is where I think the Holy Spirit can be at work in us over these next 3 weeks as we wrestle with our own internal Habakkuk. If we come to this prayer, listening in on his prayer, and we admit the fact that those are prayers that I've prayed too. So let's dive in. Because though we both know, or we all know, there's more than two of us here, though we all know that these two accusations aren't things that we really feel comfortable with, I want to let you know we're going to feel even more uncomfortable by the time we get to chapter 2, verse 4, which is where we're going to end. All right? Chapter 1, verse 2. O Lord, how long shall I cry for help and you will not hear? Or cry to you violence and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity? Why do you idly look at wrong? Here's what he lists as evidence to back that up. Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise. The law is paralyzed. Justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, so justice goes forth perverted. Now, that's his opening prayer. If you're reading along in your Bible, you're going to see some headers that kind of mark this off. This didn't show up as Sarah was reading because she just read straight from 4 to 5. But Habakkuk's prayer ends right there at the end of verse 4. That's his opening segue to God. Hey, God, I look around at my people. And if you think about the civil war that took place in Israel, we have two countries at this point. Assyria, that first or that second empire after the Egyptians, they really dealt with the northern empire. Habakkuk's dealing with the southern empire right now, the nation of Judah. And he's looking and seeing that his fellow countrymen are not living according to the law of God, are not living according to the righteousness of God. They're not demonstrating the justice of God. He's not saying the Babylonians are unjust. He's not saying anything about their enemies. He's beginning and saying, my people, my country is not going in the direction that I want. I'm sure none of you can relate to that sentiment. And he's accusing God. God, I'm the one crying out, verse 2. You're the one not listening, verse 2. Let me say to you what you ought to do. Violence! Implied in that, you should be offering salvation, but you will not save. So it's not just that I'm hunting around, I'm trying to be some busybody in my country. You are making me look at things that are wrong. That's the way he's accusing God, right? It's not as though Habakkuk is somebody who's just, you know, like that one neighbor who's just trying to figure out that the grass isn't the right height on everybody else's lawns or something like that. This is the guy that is really not wanting to see this, according to verse 3, the way he's at least saying it to God. You're making me see iniquity, but you are idly looking at wrong. And so I see around me. My fellow countrymen are destroying each other. They're being violent toward each other. And if you were to read any of the contemporary prophets of Habakkuk, you'd get the same kind of vibe. You'd get Habakkuk saying something, or you'd get Habakkuk saying the sorts of things that lots of his other fellow countrymen have talked about. These aren't unique sins to Judah, but they are real sins of Judah. He's not inventing things. These are real problems. But here's the trouble. If I bring to God's attention something that seems unfair, kind of like two kids at home, Mom, Stu got what I wanted, make it right. Habakkuk's coming and saying, Dad, God, we've got a problem here, make it right. What comes with that? A definition of what's right, right? Inherent in any one of our demands like this is an accusation already at the beginning. I know the right thing to do. You have fallen short of the standard. And you can already hear in that the problem, can't you? Because if righteousness, theologically speaking, is actually defined as what God would do if he were living out a human relationship, or what God would do if he were managing things, then it seems actually illogical to ever accuse God of doing something that's unrighteous. But Habakkuk has already taken up that stand. He feels like he knows what ought to be done, and so he's bringing it to say, hey, this is what you ought to do, right? The problem with this first accusation is that often God isn't really all that concerned about operating according to our standards. And so the first truth we have to reckon with if we're actually going to follow this God is that God's ways are unsettling. God is not worried about kowtowing to our demands, living up to our standards. In fact, often what God will do is exactly what he does here with Habakkuk. Listen to God's response to Habakkuk. Look at the nations and see. Wonder and be astounded. For I'm doing a work in your days that you would not believe if told. For behold, I'm raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, who march through the breadth of the earth to seize dwellings that are not their own. They are dreaded and fearsome. Their justice and dignity go forth from themselves. Their horses are swifter than leopards, more fierce than evening wolves. Their horsemen press proudly on. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle swift to devour. They all come for violence, all their faces forward. They gather captives like sand. At kings they scoff, and at rulers they laugh. They laugh at every fortress, for they pile up earth to take it. Then they sweep by like the wind and go on. And here's God's summary at the end. Guilty men whose own might is their God. Now that was a long description of a people that we really don't know. We would only be able to read about them from history. But understand what God is saying. Habakkuk has just said, God, I see injustice and violence and destruction around me. You don't seem to care. What are you going to do? God answers and says, you know those people, the Chaldeans, the Babylonian Empire, who has been more destructive than anything we could describe by using human terms. So I'm going to take every destructive wild animal you know, and I'm going to compare them to that. The way that leopards rip their prey apart and nothing can escape them, that's the way the Babylonians are. The way that eagles can capture anything they want, if they can see it, they can go get it, that's the way the Babylonians are. And at the end of the day, they are so strong and so impressive that they've deified their strength and they've made their own might their God. Guilty men. Here is God's answer. You see a problem, I get it, but here are the kind of people I want to use. If I just threw that phrase out to you, who are the kind of people God wants to use in this world? And you answered it honestly, and you weren't thinking about this chapter or these verses, and I just said, hey, just thinking about a sermon called What Kind of People God Uses, and I was curious, what do you think? I mean, the seniors are going out today, and we want to send them out, and I want to say, here are the kind of people that God uses. Here are just some summaries of what we just read. They are heartless, thoughtless, self-gratifying, self-justifying, terrifyingly violent, tauntingly arrogant, who bow to their strength and who boast in their guilt. Is that not what we just read? And is God's answer to Habakkuk a little unsettling to you? Because these are the people that God chooses to use. It's frustrating, isn't it? Because there's an election coming up this year, and our nations have problems. I haven't talked to anybody who's particularly satisfied with the candidates that are before us. I've talked to many folks who would say that the policies and the character of the people we need to appoint to be leaders might fit some of these characteristics that are here. And it might even be easy for us to say, God can't use those kinds of people. And yet we have God telling Habakkuk in prayer so powerfully that afterwards Habakkuk is like, I should write this down and preserve it for people. And God's Spirit says, yes, you should. I'll preserve it for thousands of generations. These are the people God chooses to use. The truth is that God's ways are unsettling. And I'm going to guess that based on the way that our country is moving, we're going to feel unsettled as we see God even working in our country. Because we have folks that feel like in government and in power in this country, that feel like they're filling out this list. Boasting in things that we ought not to boast about. Magnifying, and so we would come back and we might say along with Habakkuk, oh Lord, do you not see? You've thrust this in my face. The destruction and violence and strife and contention are just right there. It feels like your law is paralyzed. It feels like justice doesn't go forth in our country. God, what are you going to do? And it's, I'm going to make it worse. This is scripture, folks. I would love to tell you this is a unique thing that doesn't represent the character of God, and this is a unique situation for Habakkuk that we don't have to mirror because we always can trust God to do good according to our standards, except for you know I was lying because that's not the way he's worked in your life. I've walked with so many of you through conversations where I've had to recognize you have not lived the benefits of justice. In your life, you were treated deeply unfairly. It feels like that was stolen away from you. And it's easy to ask God, do you care? And it's as though if we have to square up with the truth of this text so far, the answer has to be, I do care, my child, but you can't define my concern based on your answers to your problems. Because you can imagine that Habakkuk is not content with this answer. He's not going to feel as though, God, our little problems here aren't going to be made better by greater problems, right? I mean, we're kind of sick and you're giving us poison. That doesn't feel like a good solution. And in fact, that's exactly what Habakkuk says next in his prayer. It's not that he starts by accusing God of being uncaring and then calls it quits. Habakkuk doubles down. And so his second accusation isn't just, God, you're uncaring. It's, God, you are incompetent. Listen to the way he describes this problem to God in verse 12. Are you not from everlasting, O Lord, my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. O Lord, you have ordained them as a judgment, and you, O rock, have established them for reproof. Let me just remind you of a few things, God. You who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong. That's who you are. Why then do you look idly at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than he? That's his problem, but he's not done. See, Habakkuk knows that the way that people, both in his country and in this other country, have been treating each other, right? The reputation of Judah and the reputation of the Babylonian Empire is not to act the way that God would have people act. God has made us so that we would have been acting like God should if we were doing things the way that we ought to. That concept is what it means to be made in the image of God. See, we often think of an image like a mirror. I think a better Old Testament metaphor for what it means to be made in the image of God is like a statue. And to use the Lord of the Rings illustration, there are moments that those traveling through Middle Earth will find themselves in a land not their own. And one of the main ways they know that is by the statues that they encounter. They recognize we've entered into a new realm. Why? Because an image of the king has been erected right here on the border, so that when I pass into this land, I recognize this land belongs to the one that this is made in the image of. Now the idea of us being made in the image of God means so much more. That the invisible God would want his presence made known on the earth is reflected in the fact that he's made people in his image, so that every little place we put our feet on is meant to be a representation of this is what God would do if he were here right now. Is that the way you've encountered the significant people in your life? Probably not. Maybe in some ways, yes. But you can probably point to some significant people in your life and recognize they haven't treated me the way that God would have treated me. They were made in the image of God, but they failed. But even more painful than that is having to recognize it's not just that others have failed, it's that I've failed. I was given significance. I was given power. I was given the opportunity to do good, and I didn't. I haven't just been abused in my life. I've been abusive in my life. I have not been an image of God the way I ought to, and neither have they. So, the problem, right, is that this image of God that humanity was supposed to be was supposed to rule over all of God's creation. And every lesser being was supposed to be given sort of a sense of looking up to these that were made in the image of God. That's what it meant for them to have dominion over all the different things. That's the way God described it whenever he first created people, made them in his image. But you know what's happened too often? People made in the image of God have treated others like cattle. They've treated others like farm equipment. They've treated others as though their lives were no more valuable. In fact, in order to gain the things that they were living on, they were willing to kill people to get the rocks underneath them. We've just done terrible stuff. And Habakkuk touches into that whenever he recognizes, when he starts to describe what this is like. Because look at the way he twists that idea of dominion around in verse 14. He said, God, you make mankind, made in your image, like the fish of the sea. Like crawling things that have no ruler. You've given these Babylonians permission to bring all of them up with a hook, drag them out with a net. He gathers them with his dragnet, and so he rejoices and is glad, and so he sacrifices to his net. He makes offerings to his dragnet, for by them he lives in luxury, and his food is rich. Is he then to keep on emptying his net and mercilessly killing nations forever? I'll take my stand at the watchpost, and I'll station myself on the tower, and I'll look to see what he will say to me and what I will answer concerning my complaint. Tracking the conversation so far, right? God, we in Judah are dealing with a lot of injustice. Don't worry, I'm bringing in a ruthless nation to deal with you. God, that's a really bad idea. That's kind of the summary of it so far. Now, what do you got? Habakkuk kind of rests his case here in chapter 2, verse 1, and lays it all out before God. God, here's my perspective. You are uncaring, or you are uncaring, and you are incompetent. You don't seem to care about the problems of my life. And more than that, the solutions you seem to bring into my life don't really deal with the problem. Your cure is worse than my sickness. You see why we don't write a lot of worship songs out of Habakkuk chapter 1? But if we're honest, wouldn't it be nice if we did? Because this would relate to some of the stuff we struggle with from Monday to Saturday. It's these kinds of problems that we have to wrestle with. And the second truth we have to understand, if the first is that God's ways, God does care, but his ways are unsettling. The second truth is this weird paradox that despite the fact that that's true, God's people are still settled. God's ways are unsettling, but God's people can be settled. Listen to God's answer here. The Lord answered me, write the vision, make it plain on tablets, so that he may run who reads it. For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him. But here's God's answer. Righteous people trust God. Or to use Habakkuk's words, the righteous shall live by his faith. And that's a hard one to wrestle with as an answer from God, but that's where we're going to be taking a pause in this prayer. God, I see problems. Yes, I'm going to deal with it. God, I don't like your answer. Will you trust me? Chapter 2, verse 4. Seems to be the end, because he's going to make a shift here in 5 and on, and we'll deal with that next week. But the question we have to settle before we move on to chapter 2, where the wicked are going to get their due, is will we live by faith? Can we be settled with God when his ways are unsettling? And I feel like there we've just gone from kindergarten to graduate level trying to figure out life. I wish, guys, that so much of life was lived at Sunday school levels. Here's a neat guy from the Old Testament. Look at the good things he did. Can you do those? Yes, let's go. But the problem is we find ourselves just like the Israelites camped around Mount Sinai. Here are 10 commandments. Can you do these things? Yes, let's go. All right, come on up the mountain. We ain't going up the mountain. Moses, you go. Wow, Moses waited too long. Let's make a calf. It's us. It's all us. God is scary. God is unsettling. And so we don't want to trust him. And yet Habakkuk is inviting us back in and saying, guys, this is my prayer with God. These were my devotions this morning. And I want to invite you into it because you might be struggling the way that I am. You might look back over life and say, why is he doing so well when he's been such a jerk? And God says, okay, we'll get there. But even if my ways are unsettling, can you be settled with me? Before the rest of it gets played out, will you trust me? That's the question, isn't it? And the reason I'm pausing here isn't just because I read that verse, chapter 2, verse 4, that phrase in particular, the righteous shall live by his faith, and I'm like, okay, I'm a pastor, I get to say what's important to you guys, so you got to wait with me. Sometimes I do that just because I get to. But this one I'm pausing on because 3 times in the New Testament, this verse is repeated. 3 separate times, New Testament authors are trying to make a point, and they're like, just like Habakkuk, just like Habakkuk. I want you to see what I'm saying. Just like Habakkuk. Here's the first one, Romans chapter 1. Paul says, I am not ashamed of the gospel. It's the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith, as it is written, just like Habakkuk, the righteous shall live by his faith. The point he's making there in Romans chapter 1 is that the good news that you get to trust God is available no matter your background. You can be a Jew, you can be a Gentile, it really doesn't matter. That's not the way God looks at people. The important, the unimportant, the educated, the uneducated, those who with the right parents, those without the right parents. That's not it. It's will you trust him? So important was Habakkuk's point that in the beginning of his book, he quotes him to say, that was a great summary and I want to use it. Another time Paul uses it, whenever he's talking to the Galatians. We just went through this book a little while ago, so you might remember it. He's talking about those who want to prove themselves to God and show how important they are because of all the great things they can do, which is weird because most of the things to do in the Old Testament are mainly to be done because you're not impressing God. Here's the way to make a sacrifices. Here's the way to come to God. Here's what your priest should wear so that you can actually be acceptable by God. Oh, look, we did it. We must be impressive to God. Like, oh, no, you're not getting the idea of the law at all. But here he says, all who rely on works of the law are under a curse. For it's written, cursed is everyone who does not abide by all the things written in the book of the law and do them. See, it's evident that no one is justified before God by the law. Why? Just like Habakkuk, for the righteous shall live by faith. And one other time in a sermon written by somebody we really don't know, it's the book of Hebrews. In Hebrews chapter 10, he said, faith like this isn't just the thing that, you know, brings Jew and Gentile together. Faith like this, trusting God like this, isn't just the thing that defeats legalism among you. Faith like this is the way, not just that you get into the room through the door, it's the way you make it all the way to the end, is by trusting God this way. You have need of endurance, so that when you've done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. For yet a little while, and the coming one will come and will not delay. But we could add one thing in the meantime, my righteous one shall live by faith. There's 2 more chapters to come in the book, and we'll get there over the next 2 weeks. But we're going to close by taking communion. I want to invite the worship team to come up on the stage. They're going to sing a song for us while the elements are being distributed. And the reason we wanted to tie communion to the end of this point is this. All of us struggle with the injustices done to us, and at times the injustices done to others. We struggle with them because of how deeply personal and painful they are. It feels like the worst case scenario ever at times of unrighteousness on the earth. What was God thinking? Was God not caring? Because this hurt me a lot. But here's the truth of the gospel. The good news that Jesus came to the earth is wrapped up in the fact that if anyone deserved to die, and we made a line of all those people, if anyone deserved to be punished for what they had done, and we made a line of all those people, you know who we would not find in the line? The front, not at the back. Nowhere in that line would be the one man who died. Jesus Christ bore the weight of human rebellion against God so that we could be treated as he deserves, not as we deserve. That's what we celebrate when we come to this meal, when we take communion together. So the team's going to come, they're going to get the elements as the song's being sung for us. And I want you to just think that through. Can you trust the God whose plan was to offer up Jesus for our sin so that he could be just and justified at the same time, letting him bear the weight of our sin? If we can trust that God to use that moment of injustice, I think we can trust him for all the other things that are unfair too. So, I don't know who's going to be distributing the elements, but as they're singing, they're going to come and get them, and they'll pass them out to us. Then Keith will give us some instruction going forward.